Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go to bbc.co.uk/5live.
At number 10 this week, In Her Shoes.
It's absolute rubbish, and everyone involved should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves, and it's disgraceful and rubbish.
Haven't seen it, but Mark, you know, I trust his opinion.
Transporter 2.
At 9.
It's not as good as Transporter 1, largely because there isn't a scene in which Jason Statham takes off his shirt and wrestles in oil, which was definitely the high point of Transporter 1.
Nanny McPhee, this week's number 8.
Well, I liked it. The puce colour scheme, which, as we realised last week, is in fact clearly inspired by The League of Gentlemen, but it's a better movie than The League of Gentlemen, which is still on the buses. Sorry.
The Constant Gardener, this week's number 7.
You know, overrated, she's very good, he's okay, it's not as narratively together as it should be, it's going to sweep the boards at the awards, partly because of the worthiness of its subject matter, and I think he's a very interesting director, but I don't think it's as good as City of God by quite some distance.
Yeah.
What?
I don't know, I haven't seen it.
That's no good, is it, really? No. Mrs. Henderson presents number 6.
Quaint, 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 and then some more quaint. Oh, look at them dance atop the rooftops while the Jerrys drop bombs on chipper Londoners who are swanning around with fans. I mean, you know, for heaven's sake.
Doom at 5?
Well, apparently there's been a bag of mail from people saying that I was... Well, I'm sorry. There has never been a good film based on a computer game. And you know what? There ain't never going to be. Because watching a film about a computer game is like standing behind the sofa on which the specky adolescent is playing the computer game. If you're going to play a computer game, fine. Just don't bring it into my cinema.
Nahian on this email says...
Here we go.
As someone who really respects Mark, I was pretty surprised at how flippant he was in dismissing an entire...
I'm not flippant, I'm deadly serious.
Can I finish?
I just want to be clear that it's not flippant.
I just want to finish this email. It is my programme. I was pretty surprised at how flippant he was in dismissing an entire medium of entertainment last week. It is true that the gaming industry is dominated by dullards and morons, but to dismiss the entire gaming community out of hand...
But other than that...
...is very disturbing and reminds me of the various neocons and evangelicals in America who decry gaming as Satan's work. It's like condemning films just because Jerry Bruckheimer, Michael Bay and Joel Silver are allowed to make films and a culturally irrelevant waste of space.
All of those people have made good films.
The list below contains some games that should show you how good gaming can be, and then there's a very long list which I shall pass on.
I just clarify this. I've got nothing against computer games. Actually, I have a friend who plays Doom, and he said, tells me it's very good. Fine, it's a computer game. Keep it on the computer. What I have an objection to is movies based on computer games. You know why? Because they don't have any form of narrative. Because computer games narratives are made up by the people playing the game. If I want the audience to tell me what's happening on screen, then I'll play a computer game. When I go to the cinema, I want script writers to have said... You know why they... It's Barton Fink. You know why they call writers writers? Because they're right.
We move on then. Let's talk to Andy Serkis because he's great and he's in. Actually,
we haven't got to the end of the chart yet. We're just giving up.
I'll hand it to you later. Mention that this is from Ray who lives in Nantes, and I just mentioned this because you might have an opinion on this, Andy. In reference to Mark's statement that Viggo Mortensen was the next Robert De Niro when he reviewed A History of Violence, one, Robert De Niro is only ever good when he's playing an angry Italian American. Two,
not true.
Viggo, can I finish the email? Two, Viggo Mortensen is only ever good when he's playing a reluctant king of Gondor. Did Mark mean that they are equal because they're masters at such limited roles?
It's a good gag, but Robert De Niro's best performance is in King of Comedy, in which he is not playing, you know, that, and Viggo Mortensen's best performance is in A History of Violence, which is absolutely jaw-dropping.
Absolutely, I totally agree with that. I think History of Violence is a great film. I thought he was stunning in that.
So how good is Viggo Mortensen in your opinion?
He's not only is he a great actor, he's a true artist and cares. You know, he writes. He's a poet. He's a painter. He's a photographer, and he takes. He's a really serious, creative man, and a great leader. Actually, a great leader of actors too.
Let's talk gorillas.
Okay.
Anyone who goes to see King Kong will be blown away by a whole number. Of things, it's very, very long. It takes you about an hour to get to the island. Takes you 2 hours to get to New York. But there's so much to talk about. And we see you as, you know, being a proper actor, and we can recognise you.
What do you mean a proper actor?
Well, what I mean is there's a recognisable Andy Serkis in there who's going, you know, who's got dialogue and.
No, you mean like a conventional role?
Yes, you might get spotted. You know.
Oh, that's, right, well, you know, that's right, okay, yeah.
And then there's you as King Kong. So can you just begin to describe? We're familiar with your work as Gollum, which, as you know, Mark described as the best thing in the best movies of the last 10 years. And now here we have you as this 25-foot gorilla. So tell the story, because I don't know where to start.
Oh, my God. Right. Well, it all starts with Peter during the reshoots of Return of the King.
Peter saying, Jackson.
Peter Jackson. Peter Jackson. I just assume the world knows who Peter is, actually. Because
just we're not all on first name terms. No one. That's all. Orson was saying to me that Peter's not...
Peter Jackson, during the Return of the King reshoots, invited me over to his house one Sunday afternoon. It's my birthday, April 2003. And we were just, as I say, finishing off Return of the King, and he started showing me these pictures of an albino gorilla called Snowflake in Barcelona Zoo. And I thought he was showing me his family's Snapchat album, because there are lots of, you know, also pictures of Fran and the kids, and Fran Walsh, that is, the writer who wrote Lord of the Rings. And then he said, Andy, we'd like to ask you to become involved in King Kong, using the same sort of technology that we did to bring Gollum to life, and the same ethos in that we want an actor to play the role to stop the other actors on set having to, one, imagine the CG character of Gollum, or in this case Kong, and two, we want someone to, an actor, to physicalise or just play the part of Kong so that he's making decisions for the character. And that's, so that was the basis of it, because actually more crucially with this, with Gollum, he has a lot of dialogue. I mean, he communicates with other people through the way he is, his whole psychology, the kind of the emotional journey of the character.
How did he speak again?
Oh, don't go there.
All right, sorry. I could do it, but
yeah, go on.
No,
he doesn't do impressions.
No, no, I'm particularly not in front of you. I don't.
But you know, with Kong, obviously, there's no dialogue. It's very much about communication silently, or actually, I was to find out when I started researching gorillas through vocalizations. But for the majority of the film, it's a silent communication between two actors to create this powerful emotional journey. And if that is not going to succeed, if that relationship isn't truly believable, then you know, a huge part of the movie would be underselling itself. And that's why he's a canny director, because he doesn't, you know, he's not the sort of person who would expect an actor to stand and act opposite a tennis ball and a stick and expect to get a fantastic relationship.
So in the scenes where an actor is looking straight at you,
yeah,
and reacting, either talking or jumping or smiling or laughing or running away, what are they looking at?
They are looking at, well, the majority of the scenes were with Naomi, and I was there on set, having done all my gorilla research, etc., etc. I was dressed in this gorilla suit, but I was raised up on scissor lifts and podiums. And,
so you're dressed in a gorilla suit?
I'm dressed in a gorilla muscle suit. This is there are two sort of steps to this whole journey. The first is the on-set performance, right? Yes, I had this gorilla muscle, which are all the underlying muscles of a gorilla, not the fur on top, another fur on top. And I had dentures in, and I had this sound system that I was working with, which projected the gorilla vocalizations that I was doing onto the set. And sound was a very important way of creating his presence on the set. And it used to, this real-time synthesizer dropped my vocal range down by about 3 octaves, and then it was belted out over these big speakers. So you could hear Kong roaring pretty ferociously, or just the size of his rib cage expanding and contracting through breath and so on. And then we also used music to create mood. Fran Walsh, one of the, you know, Peter Jackson's partner and script writer, chose fantastic music for us to work with, to bring us into Naomi Watts and myself into the same emotional headspace. And so it was all about creating this emotional journey and playing very specifically off what each other were doing, and not have random reactions. I mean, you could have had an actress stand there and, you know, have Pete say the directions and she respond to it, but there's nothing like acting opposite another actor for creating drama between people. It's an old-fashioned concept.
But some of the most memorable scenes between you and Naomi are where You've just seized her. You know, she was going to be a sacrifice. You've just seized her, and you've gone up to your mountain lair.
Right.
And she's trying to... So I'm telling you the story. And
you're going to love it. It really works well.
And then there's a good bit, right, where she, just to get you on board, she starts doing tricks, you know, and you absolutely love it. Anyway.
That's right.
Okay, so at the time where she's starting to do juggling and all this kind of stuff, she's seeing you up high,
yep,
sort of 20, 25 feet high, so you've got the right eye level,
yep,
and you're there with dentures and a muscle suit,
sitting up in a kind of...
she's going to crack up laughing, isn't she?
Well, no, because she's actually responding to the physicality and responding to what I'm doing and the choices that I'm making when I look to her and when I choose to ignore her and when, you know, I mean, I was just... I was. She was. It's like... It's just... exactly the same as acting opposite someone, you know, a conventional screen partner, and playing off those moments. And it's just, it's not traded off with dialogue, that's all.
Well, it's actually worth saying that it's in fact slightly more than that, because one of the horrible things that's become commonplace in movie making now is that actors often aren't there when they're not
absolutely.
On screen.
That's so, absolutely know, right.
Which is a horrible thing. I mean, that is a standard practice now. Oh, I'm not in this scene. Fine, you get the T-boy to do it. I'll be in the trailer.
That's right. I mean, it has become pretty bad in that respect.
So when we see it in this particular bit, which people will see next week, when we see a close-up of you, or when we see a close-up of King Kong, and where the eyes are looking and where the face is looking, and the whole posture, that is a CGI enforced, a re-enhanced version of what you were doing at the time? Is that the right way to describe it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, the main difference between the way we created Gollum and Kong was that with Gollum, because of the scale issues that are different with Kong, obviously, with Gollum, I was on set with Elijah Wood and Sean Astin, and we played all our scenes together, and we were in and amongst each other, and my performance was filmed on 35mm film, and then the animators would copy my facial expressions. The face was designed to fit around my features, and they literally raised the eyebrow using keyframe animation to match where my eyebrow would raise. With this, I don't bear any resemblance to Kong. Got a gorilla's face, so we decided, we did some tests, and we ended up using a facial motion capture system, which is wearing 132 facial markers, which are basically reflective little pinhead dots all over my face, which are picked up by 60 cameras around me, very, very high resolution. And these are mapped onto the CG puppet, if you like, of Kong's face. It's like a digital mask, which, if I scrunch my nose up, then Kong's nose scrunches up. It tracks eye movements, because you've got these little markers are all on your eyelids, and because your eyeballs are not perfect spheres, it the way it moves the eyelids and deforms the eyelids, if you like, can track your gaze. So if I look to the right, then Kong looks to the right, or you know, wherever he's looking. So, and a lot of gorillas, obviously, same as human beings, you know, the eyes are very, very important in the way that they communicate and express emotion.
So of all the time that we see Kong in the movie, is it always you, or are there some... one of the most terrific sequences is where Kong takes on three Tyrannosaurus Rexes. You've got Naomi in one hand and you're fighting the dinosaurs. That's just a sensational sequence. Is that you? Or is that all CGI? Are there some bits of Kong which are just CGI?
There are some bits... I mean, the animators... Obviously, where there are physically impossible things to... I mean, the thing about physical motion capture is what it does is it very much roots the... You get the physics, the biomechanics of, and weight. I mean, I had my motion capture suit, I had big, heavy weights on to give a sense of Kong's arms being like wrecking balls when he's swinging them forward, and the same with the feet. There's a really good, you get a sense of the physics of the character relating to the environment, you know, really clunking down onto the ground and so on. And sometimes, like when he's throwing the cars around, I'd be hoiking these great big, very, very, you know, lead weighted cars, so that you got a sense of him putting some heft into it. For scenes like that, for that Tyrannosaurus Rex scene, there are the dramatic beats within that scene, which are Kong's facial expressions and reactions to getting bitten, and seeing Anne drop and him catching her. We facially motion captured the entire scene, but for the bits where he's fully interacting with three CG Tyrannosaurus Rexes, that was keyframe animated with my face. Facially motion captured, put on top of the physicalized stuff. So it was a mix and match for that particular sequence. But I think that's the key sequence where the animators really drive the character, if you like. For the most part, it's driven physically and facially by me.
Just to say, although again, that's actually perfectly normal in any performance in an action movie. The action sequences are not usually played by the key performers. They're either played by stuntmen or they're played by special effects. I mean, look at Spider-Man, for example.
Well, Naomi in the in that very sequence isn't there. It's a digital double of Naomi, but you'll then cut to a close-up of her responding to being dropped or whatever. Yeah. You know what I mean? So digi actors are not just confined to, you know, people playing 25-foot gorillas. There's a lot of CG digi actors in Kong for all the other characters.
We'll do more with Andy Serkis, whose name is Fur. You see King Kong starring Andy Serkis. That's what it says then. How great is that?
And Andy Serkis as Kong.
Yeah, well, is your name first or is your name first?
It's Andy Serkis as Kong.
Yeah, but we see what I'm saying is we see your name first.
Oh, I see.
Before any other actors.
Oh, no, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, I think we do. Well, he did in my version.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll have to get you one.
Makes you number one, sir. That's what it makes. Andy Serkis and Mark Kermode. More in just a moment. 3:20.
M1 in West Yorkshire, northbound.
3:22. Mark Kermode is here. Andy Serkis is King Kong. And also, what's the name of your character?
Lumpy.
Lumpy. Lumpy the cook. Lumpy the chef. It was a
he's not just the chef. He's the tattooist, barber and mortician.
Indeed. Indeed. So if you're waiting for a Narnia review, I think what we'll do is we'll talk with Andy up until we hear from Tony Blair, because there's a press conference coming up about the EU rebate. And then the other side of that, we'll talk
Narnia.
About Narnia, because a number of people are waiting for that. For example, this for Paul and Milton Keynes after Jonathan Ross giving Narnia a complete panning. I'm quivering in anticipation of another vintage Kermode rant. You don't even know if you're going to get one. You might be pleasantly surprised. Carol in Essex. This is because we did the top 10 earlier, although we stopped at number 4, I think, because we didn't get any further than that.
Do you want to finish it?
Still missed the top 10 to fetch the kids. Why don't you start at 2? Carol in Essex. Old-fashioned portable transistor radio is the answer. I listen to you while walking the dog over very slippery fields.
Very good.
Mark in Stroud. Got to go on the school run now at 5:03. Can you do a rerun at about 3:20? Well, what we could...
It's public service broadcasting,
we could finish it, because we've got as far as Doom at 5. Right. So number 4 is Keeping Mum.
It's rubbish. I mean, you know, Rowan Atkinson's a vicar, and there's, you know, and Maggie Smith's a murderer.
The Exorcism of Emily Rose, number 3.
Yeah, not as bad as it could have been. You know, half a good movie and half a very bad movie. Half a good movie.
Flight Planet 2?
Well, you know, it's not Red Eye, and it wishes it was, but it sadly isn't. It takes itself much too seriously. There's a good half until you get halfway through, and then you realise that they've given up and they're going to do that other silly film.
Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, still the UK's number 1.
Better than 1 and 2, not as good as 3. Scary at the end for anyone under the age of 8, I would definitely say.
I had a very shocking conversation with your colleague on Newsnight Review, Mark Lawson, about Harry Potter, which I don't really feel as though I can do it on the air, but very distressing.
Really?
Yeah.
You tell me afterwards.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you write,
I have no idea what it is.
No, it's very shocking.
Okay.
It shocked lots of people.
Crikey.
Jean in North London, on the subject of no good video game adaptations.
Yep.
To Mark.
Go on.
Really? What about the Peter Jackson produced, Alex Garland written, and possibly Guillermo del Toro directed adaptation of Halo, due to start filming next year?
Well,
I think he's going to be proved wrong.
Well, it would be very interesting to be proved wrong. Guillermo del Toro is a fantastic director, and I think Kronos is a marvellous piece of work, and the Devil's Backbone is a fantastic piece of work as well. So, you know, hey, somebody might yet do it. It hasn't yet been done, and I think it would take an awful lot to do it. But, hey, you know, you never know. I mean, I was famously wrong about, you know, motion capture and performance. I mean, as we all know, I mean, before I knew what it was, I mean, well, that's not acting. How can it possibly be? Before I made the world's most public retraction on that subject. So, you know. No, listen, you know, we've all been wrong. I didn't like Blue Velvet the first time I saw it. It is possible, occasionally, that, as Fonzie said, I was not quite right.
So, do you think that this kind of performance is now being started? You know, we're beginning to understand what people like you can do. I mean, you're the number one guy on this. I'm not sure if there's anyone else who's doing it, but we're almost into a new kind of realm of acting, aren't
we? I mean, it's interesting because there's this whole debate about, you know, how do you categorise it, or how, I mean, I think it's important to have terminology, because it I mean, only because actually what I think it is at the end of the day is just acting. and when there's talk of, well, it should be called digi acting or cyber thespianism or something, you know.
Cyber thespianism. Excellent.
So that's something you pay money for doing a club in King's Cross, isn't it?
the process involved is pure acting. I you know, I get inside the character and I play the part, and that's it, really, bottom line. And the interface between whether you have, well, I mean, the only difference is that with a conventional screen character such as Lumpy in King Kong, you know, you put on a costume, you have makeup, and it's you know, you're affected by those externals.
Was it No, you're the star.
No, thanks. And then with a CG performance, or what, you know, or, you know, a character like Gollum or Kong, the costume effect is added after the fact, and that is the only difference. I mean, obviously there's the whole enhancement aspect to it, but from an acting point of view, I mean, Zemeckis did He did Polar Express, and I think he's just done Beowulf, or he's doing Beowulf.
Right. Okay.
Totally using motion capture, and or performance capture, as I think it should be called, not motion capture. Motion capture is putting dots all over, like a tennis ball, and rolling it across a motion capture stage, and it tracking the movements. It sort of is rather clinical and doesn't describe really fully what it is that we do. You know,
when you were approached by Peter Jackson to get involved with this, as you said, ran at his house in the middle of the Lord of the Rings business. Did you say to him then, fine, yes, absolutely, could I be in it in another role as well?
No, absolutely not. I mean, that came after the fact. I mean, to be asked to play Kong was like asked to be playing Hamlet. I mean, I treated it as a serious role as a, you know, any Shakespearean part or any well-written role, because I knew it would be well-written by great screenwriters. And it would be his retelling would be a fresh interpretation, and that's exactly what it feels like making this film. It is like taking a classic tale or like a Shakespearean production or a Greek tragedy and doing a retelling of it for this generation.
So what do you get to do next, Andy?
Well, it's a good question. I actually what I am going to do next is do some directing. I'm setting up to do a project next year, which is based on an autobiography by a man called Stephen Smith, and the book's called Addict, and it's about it's a fantastic survival story about his life, which kind of goes from the 50s to the 70s as a life as a dexedrine addict. It was a quite popular book, and it's a very, very harrowing and great story. So that's what I'm doing, apart from acting.
Is it something that you're just going to try and then carry on with the acting, or do you fancy this actually, having watched a master at work, someone like Peter Jackson, which must be a fantastic education?
Well, absolutely, and that was one of the great things about playing these two roles that Gollum and Kong was that I had my feet in many other camps apart from the acting camp in these productions, because I was party and witness to fantastic processes that I've learned about. But I mean, not that they'll be employed in this next film, but no, I mean, directing is always something I've wanted to do, and I've directed some short films and a play, and it feels right that, well, I mean, I don't exclusively want to be a director, but it feels like I can tell this story as a director better than I can as an actor, and therefore I'm choosing appropriately what I want to do.
Now, Mark hasn't seen King Kong. No. We'll get to, so basically the story of the Christmas box office battle is going to be a gorilla against a lion.
Again, a lion and four kids.
And we'll hear the Narnia review coming up, by the way, as I said, because when we finish speaking to Andy, there's an EU press conference with Tony Blair, and then we'll do the rest of the movies. Famously, of course, Narnia is out this week. You'll hear what Mark thinks about it. But having been, Andy, in these two, if you take Lord of the Rings as one, but you've been involved in these two extraordinary films, everything else has got to be small in comparison, hasn't it? I mean, it is a monster of a film, literally.
It is. It's massive. And, you know, it has kind of occupied 2 years of my life, and as Lord of the Rings sort of did three or four. But the thing is, the next thing is always the most important thing, because once you get involved in it, that's the biggest challenge. Regardless of scale, it becomes all-consuming, and whether it's a fringe play or a, you know, as from an acting point of view, when you're playing a character, that becomes it. You know, doesn't it? Really, scale doesn't actually matter.
Give us one final thought when we go and see King Kong, and Mark will be seeing it in a couple of days' time. What's the one thing you would like us to have in our minds as we're sitting through this? I mean, it is 3 hours. It doesn't feel like 3 hours, but what's the one thing as we watch your performance? What do we need to be thinking?
Oh, I wouldn't prescribe anything to an audience, but what I would say is the relationship between Kong and Anne, and Kong as a gorilla, because he was very much rooted in real gorilla behaviour, hopefully, because we're 97% genetically the same as gorillas, but it's the 3% of otherness that I'm interested in people's response to, because every single scene between Kong and Anne should be in a way an open book for people to project their own set of emotions. We didn't over humanise him to the point where we're spoon feeding every single emotion and telling the audience what to think. Hopefully, if we've done our job right, and I think we have, we've left that mysterious 3% for audiences to be able to make their own minds up about what Kong is thinking and feeling at any given moment.
Good to meet you again, Andy. Thanks,
yeah,
for
you too.
Thanks very much indeed for coming in. Cheers. King Kong opens next week. Narnia is the big story of this week. Review to come. As I mentioned, we're waiting for this press conference from Tony Blair. He's been talking to loads of prime ministers from around Europe. We've got pictures at the moment inside Downing Street. All I can see is a painted door and a Christmas tree. Could be anywhere, I'm told.
It's Narnia.
Downing Street. It is. It's almost a wardrobe. And look, there's Mr. Tumnus just wandering past. Oh, no, it's Jack's drawer. Anyway, we'll hear more from Downing Street fairly shortly, and reviews to come. Mayo at bbc.co.uk is the email. It's 5live@3:32. Good afternoon. You're listening to 5 Live. Nice to meet Andy Serkis again. King Kong opens next week. The big box office release of this week is The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, Chronicles of Narnia. As I said, we might get interrupted by Downing Street, but let's see where we go.
OK, so the first instalment, The Chronicles of Narnia, long awaited. I think they're going to do all... Is it 7 altogether?
I think they're going to wait and see, because we spoke to William Moseley, who plays Peter, and he didn't really seem to know whether he was in the next one
or not,
or whatever. Okay. I think they're going to wait and see.
OK, well, Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe was clearly the most famous one. Shot in New Zealand, like Lord of the Rings, actually shot at the same time as King Kong. Story of four kids evacuated from London to a country park, from Finchley, in fact, to a country park during the war. They discover a large wardrobe, to go through the wardrobe into the land of Narnia, in which it is winter but never Christmas, due to the reign of the Snow Queen, played by Tilda Swinton, who manages to seduce one of the children, effectively to betray his friends for sweeties.
What is your name, son of Adam?
Edmund.
And how, Edmund, did you come to enter my dominion?
I'm not sure. I was just following my sister.
Your sister? How many are you?
Four. Lucy's the only one that's been here before. She said she met some fawn called Tumnus. Peter and Susan didn't believe her. I didn't either.
Edmund, you look so cold. Come sit with me.
Tilda Swinton is actually rather good. The rest of the cast, you know, top quality sort of homegrown cast. Jim Broadbent as the Professor. Liam Neeson is the voice of Aslan the Lion. Ray Winston and Dawn French as the Beavers. Rupert Everett as the Fox. Blah, 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 blah. Directed by the guy who directed the first Shrek movie, and so consequently, you know, lots of cuddly, cute talking animals, which will be a hit with the younger viewers. It doesn't have any of the darkness of Lord of the Rings, or in fact, of the later Harry Potter movies. It's very much playing to a younger audience, and within those sort of cute talking animals, they will get something out of it. Also, it is a good story. You really have to try quite hard to really damage the story of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. There's been a lot of stuff about the Christian allegory side of it, and clearly it is a Christian allegory. I mean, there is... I really don't think I'm giving anything away with this. Aslan is the Christ figure. Aslan has the death and resurrection scene, which is mounted in a very, very religious tableau, which specifically refers to the women watching and mourning while this stuff all happens. We have Edmund, who is either, you know, the sin of mankind, or is perhaps Judas in some interpretations. You have Peter, who is the... I mean, I feel like I'm filling in the obvious stuff, but it's all there. Now, there's been some discussion about, will younger kids get this? Well, if they've been to Sunday school, and if they know anything at all about the biblical story, yes, they won't. Yes, they will. But, you know, it is all there. The problem with it is it's just not great. Now, I didn't hear Jonathan Ross's review, so I don't know what he said, but it's not terrible by any means. It's just not very good. And the problems are, firstly, it's visually rather disappointing. I mean, in the age in which we now have, you know, motion capture, performance capture, incredible CGI work, all that sort of thing, it is quite sad to see a movie which cannot get the lighting right between the interior and the exterior. There's that kind of Doctor Who thing that when they're in a forest and it's an interior, it's lit one way, then they walk about five paces, then they're an exterior shot and they seem to be on a different planet. They've never quite sorted that out. The other thing is the CGI animals are very, very cartoony, particularly the beavers, in a not particularly physical way. I mean, Ray Winston's voice is great, obviously, and, you know, good vocal performances, but that's not enough. There is also an awful lot of sub-Lord of the Rings sweeping cinematography, particularly in the scenes of the battles, in which, actually, I have to say, to some extent, the same thing was true of Kingdom of Heaven, the Ridley Scott movie, although this is not in the same league as Kingdom of Heaven, in which you just think, I have seen those shots done much better, much more credibly, much more... I mean, once you've got to the end of the Lord of the Rings and you've had the storming of Hell's Deep and you've had the orcs and you've had that incredible onslaught, the real visual spectacle, it just looks a bit tacky. And I think for the younger viewers, that's not going to be a problem, because I think the younger viewers, they'll like the animals, they'll like the story, they'll like the kids, and the kids are charmingly enough played. I mean, obviously, they're playing in that very, very British way, and that's exactly...
And the youngest kid is supposed to be particularly...
She is, yeah, she's enchanting.
A scene stealer.
She is absolutely enchanting, but it's an enchanting role. That's the point is, it's a very, very well-written, enchanting role, and she does it well, and that stuff is all fine. And Tilda Swinton is very good as, the evil queen, because... As somebody else has pointed out, Tilda Swinton has got this kind of... There is a real archetypal quality to her. She's not so much a performer as a sort of presence. I mean, there is something very chilling about her when she does this role, and she does it very well. The main problem with the film is that, in the end, it's too long. There could have been some compression of the story. I know, most of what happens in the film actually happens in the book anyway, but I think they should have cut it down slightly, because you really do get a sense halfway through that it is bagging down rather badly. It's aiming itself at a young, young audience who I think may get restless. And the spirituality that's in the original text, which people are getting terribly huffy about, hey, it's a Christian allegory, leave it alone, that's what it is. It is all there, but somehow the movie doesn't seem to quite have the weight to carry it off. So when you get, for example, to the scenes of Aslan's sacrifice, although they're actually physically rather well rendered, the digital work on Aslan, particularly on his mane, is very well done, it does feel a little pop video-ish. Like I said, it's neither great nor bad. It's too long, it's a bit tacky, it's a bit clunky, but it's charming in its performances, particularly in the younger cast and in the performance by Tilda Swinton. And the story itself is, I would say, damn near indestructible. What it doesn't have is real solid heart and spirit. And I think that is a problem for the older viewers. So unlike Lord of the Rings, which I think was really, across the age boundaries, I think this is definitely a younger kids' movie.
Your mate Pete Bradshaw in The Guardian wrote... C.S. Lewis's blah, 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 blah. The result is a triumph, gorgeous to look at, superbly cast, wittily directed, funny and exciting by turns. And the reason I mention it is he says perhaps Mel Gibson would have preferred Aslan to be whipped with barbed wire for 30 minutes before the main event, but Adamson handles it with finesse.
Well, I disagree with that. PG contains mild threat, battle and fantasy violence is the BBFC's recommendation. And, obviously, if you know the story, you will understand that there is death and loss and tragedy, but there's also redemption in it. And I would say, clearly don't take incredibly young kids who are going to be really, really upset at the point at which Aslan dies. You might actually want to prime them in advance for the story that it's based on. It's okay, it has a happy ending. But, it's a PG movie, and it's definitely playing to the... I am surprised to hear anyone say that it's visually... visually lovely or enchanting?
Gorgeous to look at, superbly cast, wittily directed, fun and exciting.
I think gorgeous to look at, it certainly isn't. But hey, everyone's entitled to their own opinion. I just happen to be right about this.
And on the various different subtexts...
Yes.
I mean, an awful lot of movies have a kind of...
They seem to
have, like, what they're trying to say is, the military, it's quite fun.
I know.
Whichever way you behave in life, there are no consequences. There are all kinds of messages which films do have.
It is astonishing because does this look like this is about to start, or can I just tie this in with
the? I'm afraid that looks like the Prime Minister. He's addressing a press conference. Questions about Narnia, yeah. James. On this, should I take my 4.5-year-old? See Narnia. He liked Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Loves all the Pixar films and Star Wars and so on.
It's a difficult call. I mean, it's...
That's very young.
It is young, yeah, absolutely. And one of the things you have to remember is watching movies in the cinema is very different to watching movies on DVD. And an awful lot of it is just to do with the sheer scale. I mean, I took a 7-year-old to see Corpse Bride, and she didn't like it. She went with some other people. She didn't like it, and she asked to leave. And I said, what was it? Was the problem, you didn't like the skeletons with the eyes falling out? She said, no, it was just so big. And she said that she had seen the Magic Roundabout movie before and asked to leave that as well because it was just so big. Narnia is a big, wide, full-on experience with big sound as well. So in the end, the only people that can judge this are the parents or the guardians. That's why the BBFC call it a PG. I'm not in any way being patronising about this. You have to judge your kids for yourself.
One question, particularly involving kids that age, given the fact that the death of Aslan, whatever happens afterwards, it's very upsetting in the book.
It's very upsetting.
So that's going to be quite tough for someone who's under five.
Yes, exactly. I mean, unless to some extent they already are familiar with the story, which many children will be already, and they know where it's going. I mean, remember, children... understand the story of Easter. Children understand, you know, the basic Christian mythology on which this is based. That's why I'm saying, in a way, understanding that stuff makes it more tolerable, because you know when you get to the death of Aslan where this is actually going to.
I suspect most kids won't.
OK, well, fine, but, you know, then... OK, what am I going to do?
The world, eh?
The world.
What else is out?
Well, sticking with the Christian allegory thing, March of the Penguins, which is this record-breaking documentary, took $77 million in the States, which is second only to Fahrenheit 9/11, although obviously this is better, but most things are better than Fahrenheit 9/11, frankly. Michael Medved, who's a, you know, somebody of whom I have no respect at all, was
quoted...
He's a critic. He's actually, funnily enough, the person who was responsible for the Golden Turkey Awards years ago, but now he's become a critic who sort of holds forth about the morality of the world.
Who says things like, the world, God.
Yes, exactly. Exactly like that. And basically, there's this documentary about the emperor penguins. The emperor penguins are an extraordinary, breed of animal who every year make this Antarctic trek to the most hostile place on Earth where they mate. And then the male emperor penguins are then famously left holding the egg while the female penguins go off to get some fish, because they've been giving birth to the egg or hatching the egg. Hatching the egg.
We know what you're saying.
Up until that point. Now, the documentary is voiced by Morgan Freeman, who in the past has played God, of course, in Bruce Almighty, and he's played the president, and now he's doing the most difficult thing of all, which is playing David Attenborough, which I think is the one thing which is just above those two. I was going to play you a clip, but I'm not going to, because I think we should just move straight on. Basically, what happened was, in America when this came out, a bunch of right-wing Christians said, this is clearly a Christian allegory, it's proof of the existence of God, look at this, there's obviously divine intervention in what these penguins are doing, and Michael Medved said, it's the first movie that us non-liberals have enjoyed since The Passion of the Christ, this is The Passion of the Penguins, and he said that it reaffirms traditional norms like monogamy, sacrifice, and child-rearing. Well, a couple of things on this. Firstly, the penguins, as it says in the documentary, are monogamous year on year. There are rock stars who are monogamous year on year. I mean, that's really not such a big thing. The other thing is there are several reports, and I'm sure you've all seen them, of gay penguins in zoos. It's a very, very common thing, apparently. I mean, if you don't believe me, you know, just go onto Google and put in gay penguins. They are as open in their partnerships as human beings are. There's nothing absolutely straightforward and heterosexual about that. And what?
No, it's just, this isn't what the film's about, is it?
No, it's not.
Well, it's impossible to review the film without reviewing what everyone else is saying about it.
No, but what I'm saying is, also, the fact of the matter is, there is suffering, there is death, there is, you know, little cute penguins not making it. Okay, so do not be led into thinking that everything's fluffy, everything's nice, everything's lovely, everything's woolly. Although it doesn't have the real hard edges of, for example, you know, some of the Attenborough documentaries that we've seen, it isn't all cuddly.
Well, watch David Attenborough's stuff about insects and bugs and find out what wildlife is like, you know, because if you get the mating process wrong, you might lose your head.
And when you asked him about it, he said that, you know, he doesn't see divine intervention in this, because when you imagine, you know, a worm burrowing itself into somebody's eyeball and turning somebody blind, how can you see that as a divine thing? Now, personally...
But this is nothing to do with the penguin film, is it?
It is something to do with the penguin on the following basis. The film is voiced by Morgan Freeman, who does a terribly seductive and actually very anthropomorphic voiceover. Okay, for example, there is a moment in which one of the penguin's chicks dies, and the voiceover says, her grief is unbearable, her reaction is unimaginable. You go, no, it's not, because they're animals. They are not human beings. You can't talk about them experiencing grief in the same way that we understand grief. I'm not saying they don't experience grief. What I'm saying is we don't know what emotions penguins experience in, you know, it, you cannot do the Disney thing of just turning them into animals. Now, of course, it is entirely possible to watch the documentary, as I did, incidentally, and go, I'm sorry, this happened by chance. It's just completely accidental that this extraordinary evolutionary thing happened, whereby the penguins know where they're going to every year, and they do it, and they reproduce, and they say, well, this is accident. I don't believe that. So I do actually believe in there being some kind of, you know, greater design. However, what I don't believe is that greater design is the kind of thing being waved around by Michael Medved, meaning that, in fact, it's saying monogamy is good. We must all stay at home and look after each other. It's not as simple as that. So my key point here is, it's perfectly possible to look at March of the Penguins and have a religious interpretation of it without falling for all the nonsense, all the rubbish, all the bigotry that's been spouted about it religiously in America.
So is it possible it's possible to go and see this film? I mean, basically, I think I wish I'd never heard anything about what the Americans are saying about it.
No, it's important, Simon. It is important.
Can't you just enjoy it for what it is, whether it's a good documentary?
Yes, you can.
That's all I'm saying.
Well, yes, but it's a flawed documentary because the voiceover is much too anthropomorphic and because it doesn't quite have the strength of its convictions. And because the voiceover is actually the thing that has led people to go off in these strange tangents. But all I'm saying is, even as we dismiss those, you know, the lunatic things that have been said in America, that doesn't mean the film does not have a spiritual dimension, because it doesn't mean that it's impossible to look at. I mean, it really is possible to look at penguins and go, I'm sorry, I think there is something, there is some kind of guiding hand in all this.
And do you think there were some gay penguins in this film that maybe were just out of shot, that they deliberately cut out?
Well, apparently you can't tell, you can't see when you look at them. Apparently this gay penguins in this zoo, this is this lovely news story, they said that they only found out that they were gay penguins because they'd been together for 6 years, they'd been mating regularly, and they finally did a DNA test that turned out they were both blokes. That was why they weren't having any eggs. Even the people who ran the zoo didn't know. You can't tell, they're penguins. They look like, you know, blokes in dinner jackets.
Movie of the week.
Calvaire, but we didn't get there. It's a French-Belgian gore-slasher-horror movie, and guess what? It has religious connotations. Calvaire in France, in French, in Belgium, means ordeal, but it also means Calvary. Go see the film and work it out for yourself.
Is there a wardrobe?
No.
Is there CGI?
No.
Okay. Have a good weekend. We're back Monday at 1 o'clock. Drive is next.
Live news, live sport.